Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
The 9/11 attacks mean Al-Qaeda will always have a place in history, and the years since 9/11 have seen ever more information about Al-Qaeda coming into the public domain, not least because of the documents and files seized in Abbottabad, Pakistan, where bin Laden was living before he was killed. Well, Nelly LaHood, senior fellow in New America's International Security Program, has had access to a lot of papers, and she joins us now. So hello, first of all.
Hi, Owen. Thank you for hosting me.
And just tell us, first of all, what papers have you seen?
Well, to make it clear to the listeners, the papers are actually accessible to anyone. The first batch of declassification occurred through the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point. At the time, it was the Office of the Director of National Intelligence that did the declassification. And then subsequently, that same office declassified documents on its own website under the Bin Laden bookshelf. But then in November 2017, the CIA declassified everything that they're going to declassify, a massive volume of files. We're talking about thousands and thousands of files, including text files, audio and video files. And they didn't categorize them. So I must have clicked on thousands of files before I determined that really the text files is where I'm going to find Al-Qaeda's internal communications. And with the help of two research assistants, we went through all the text files, nearly 97,000 files. And sure enough, we found Al-Qaeda's internal communications there, nearly 6,000 Arabic pages. And once we identified the internal communications, that's when I really proceeded to reading and analyzing these documents and writing the book.
And you are the only person, I mean, you and your team are the only people who have looked at these documents in this detail, do you think?
I believe I'm the only person who has read all the documents, but maybe there are others elsewhere, I don't know. But yes, I've read all the 6,000 pages.
Yeah. And just tell us about the title of the book and who published it. And so if people want to find the full sort of version of what we're talking about today, where they can go for that.
Well, the book's title is The Bin Laden Papers, How the Abbottabad Raid Revealed the Truth About Al-Qaeda, Its Leader, and His Family. And it was published in April this year by Yale University Press.
Now then, let's just talk about what you've found out from the archive. And I should say, you know, the series is The Future Of, and we will briefly address that at the end of the interview, but by its nature on this topic, a lot is going to be on the past before we just look ahead a bit. And, you know, you've found lots of interesting things in these papers. And let me just start with one to kick off with. And that is, the general understanding has been that the idea for the 9/11 attacks was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's, that it was his idea. And you found a document which suggests bin Laden at least claimed it was his idea.
I don't think this was a claim. He had no reason to lie. But one of the papers that were recovered is a sheet of paper that he composed in September 2002. There were a couple of paragraphs in his own handwriting on this. And we find out from these paragraphs that he was inspired by a specific plane crash that occurred on October 31, 1999, when an Egypt Air flight crashed off the New England coast, killing 217 people. It turned out that the pilot, Gamil al-Batuti, had vengeful motives against his employer. And these couple of paragraphs in bin Laden's handwriting, they reveal that upon hearing the news, bin Laden turned to the two people who were with him at the time and said, well, why didn't he crash into one of the financial towers? And then in the following paragraph, he says, well, this is how the idea was conceived in my mind, and this is when we started the planning. The general assumption is that it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed who came up with the idea. This was included in the 9/11 Commission report and so on. And it's not a question of competition here between bin Laden and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. And there's no reason why bin Laden would want to lie about this.
Isn't there a reason? I mean, because this was after the attack, right? This document was written after 9/11.
Right. It was written in September 2002.
But I mean, he was quite boastful, wasn't he? I mean, he used, you know, and he had hubris. I mean, I remember something he said that, you know, he understood that the towers were collapsing exactly that way because he was an engineer. And it was extremely unconvincing when he said it that, you know, he really did predict that. And
that's not part of the notes.
I'm just saying that in general terms, wasn't he quite a sort of, you know, he had a very exaggerated view of himself, and he'd love to claim this kind of thing.
The paragraphs, the way they were written, this was not boasting at all. This is by accident. So he didn't really claim that he somehow came up with a brilliant idea. He was inspired by an event that happened. I don't see anything that is irreconcilable between what occurred and bin Laden's notes here. He was not showing off. And in fact, this sheet of paper that I'm talking about, he ended up stopping in the middle of the sentence because he was disappointed with two of the hijackers about their inability to do anything when they sent them to the United States. So clearly he was recording too much information. So it's not a question of bousting there is no showing off at all here.
Okay.
And that's all the more reason why we should really believe him.
No, sure. And you've got, you know, the sense of the documents and everything because you've been through them all, and you can, you know, you'll be able to work out when you know, boastful claims are being made and otherwise. Another very interesting thing that came out of the papers, I thought, was, which I guess people know, but it was that Al-Qaeda really was taken aback by the scale of the US response to 9/11. Just talk us through that.
We learned from the letters that Al-Qaeda did not expect that the United States would launch a war against Afghanistan. They hoped or they expected that they would do a limited airstrike. So when the war occurred, Al-Qaeda had no plan A. And we find out that the Taliban's regime collapsed rapidly. We discover in the letters that bin Laden had to disappear out of necessity. He probably did so around November 2001. And for nearly 3 years, he did not communicate with his associates, even though he did release public statements. And we know this because the letters that were composed in 2004, they all seem to be briefing bin Laden about during the past 3 years, what happened. And we find bin Laden commenting for the first time in 2004 about things that occurred in 2002. And we find one letter explicitly stating, after your disappearance. And so clearly he disappeared for several years, and the letters that he received when they were apprising him of the situation, they were speaking about Al-Qaeda's dire conditions, the ordeals of Al-Qaeda. It was firstly because of the Taliban regime collapsed rapidly. And then we find out, again, for the first time from the letters, that Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban, ordered the Arabs to evacuate Afghanistan altogether because they sensed that the air campaign was targeting Arabs and their families. Al-Qaeda was in disarray, and as well as other Arab jihadis at the time, and they had to evacuate Afghanistan. They proceeded, their first escape destination was Pakistan, and there they were met by what the letters describe as a comprehensive campaign of arrest in the large and the minor cities, and quote-unquote 600 brothers were captured. So the other senior leaders of Al-Qaeda ended up heading illegally, crossing illegally into Iran, where eventually they were detained. And what we also learn from the letters is that Al-Qaeda's capabilities were shattered, and Al-Qaeda was not able to mount any international terrorism after 9/11. The only attack that Al-Qaeda succeeded in carrying out after 9/11 was the 2002 Mombasa bombings that occurred in November 2002. And the reason they were able to pull it off is because the operatives had been dispatched from Afghanistan to East Africa before 9/11.
Right. And despite that, it's very stark what you say there, that was only just one attack after 9/11. But, the Western media was constantly ascribing every attack to Al-Qaeda, weren't they? So you got the impression they were doing lots of stuff.
Everything that occurred was somehow, it was believed that Al-Qaeda was behind it, as if Al-Qaeda was really at the center of global jihad. And in fact, that was far from reality. Al-Qaeda, in the letters, in the words of its own leaders, they were shattered.
And one of the reasons for that was not just the arrests in Pakistan, but also the drone campaign. And I think you've got very interesting material on that, because in the West and in Pakistan, the drones were considered very counterproductive for America to be doing it. There's all these arguments about it creates more jihadis than it destroys and so on. And that narrative is very firmly set still. And yet your papers, the papers you've seen, show a very different story.
Initially it was the campaign and the US air campaign, but then they really felt that they needed to hide. The drones started early, but they escalated around 2008 onwards. And this is when we find in the letters that every second letter was reporting about, quote-unquote, the martyrdom of brothers in North Waziristan. But in the area in between, what also Al-Qaeda discovered is that they ceased to feel secure in their own environment. They felt that they could be betrayed by the Afghan Taliban. The letters spoke about how most of the Afghans were lured by American dollars. And then the drone campaign escalated around 2008. And you're absolutely right. The drones were so effective. They were effective because it seems that the CIA threw considerable money in terms of recruiting spies in North Waziristan and broadly in the Fatah, the federally administrative tribal areas of Pakistan. So they were able to recruit many spies. Al-Qaeda's letters speak, they use language that the area is infested with spies. We learn also from the letters that the drones were very precise in terms of their targeting. It's not just ceasing its operational activities. They couldn't even go to take the car to the garage, they were so precise, and they had enough information, reconnaissance information, that Al-Qaeda didn't know what to do with them. But the other thing is, what we also find out from the letters about the drones, which is often omitted by those who support the drone campaign, is that Al-Qaeda managed, despite its lack of resources, managed to dismantle some spying network in the region and to figure out how the drones operated. The problem that Al-Qaeda faced is that they didn't have the discipline to be able to take the security measures required to evade the drones. And as far as Al-Qaeda's security committee was concerned, it was simple to evade the drones. All they needed to do was to hide. And here we're talking about a completely different culture that the jihadis had to that they were facing in North Waziristan. These people had taken up jihad to fight and not to hide, and all of a sudden they found themselves having every single movement that they made was being monitored. And the other issue, that in Islam it is unlawful to spy on fellow Muslims. And Al-Qaeda found itself having to spy on fellow Muslims in order to dismantle the spying network. So these were insurmountable obstacles that Al-Qaeda faced as it tried to deal with the drone campaign.
Yeah, I mean, just to ask you about that hiding point you made. I mean, Bin Laden is a very interesting letter or document that you saw where bin Laden said, look, I can do it, I'm hiding. It shows that I can do it because I'm managing quite well not to get targeted. But it also seemed to me that the level of hiding required was so extreme that it did incapacitate them. I mean, they could hardly communicate even.
Exactly. I mean, you're absolutely right. They spoke about movement being impossible. And this kept coming up in the letters time and again, where bin Laden's associates would tell him, movement is the major problem for us. So you're absolutely right. It was incapacitating for them.
Now then, let's turn on to another topic, which is, you know, very important for understanding, you know, the success or failure of al-Qaeda. Some people would say that its failure rested on its inability to control sectarian violence within its number, within its ranks. How true do you think that is, that the killing of Shias did create massive problems for al-Qaeda and undermined bin Laden's purpose?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I mean, there were many failures for al-Qaeda. I mean, those that we just spoke about, and the fact that al-Qaeda was incapacitated and couldn't carry out any international terrorism. Now, it's the other issue of the sectarianism was a catch-22 for al-Qaeda. Initially, the parent group of the Islamic State that was led by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi seemed like a lifeline for al-Qaeda. When Zarqawi asked to merge with al-Qaeda in 2004, this pleased bin Laden very much. The hope was that Zarqawi would unite jihadi militants in Iraq under one umbrella, and they would all act in unison against the occupying forces. Now, Zarqawi failed to unite these groups and to consolidate himself in Iraq, and he focused his attacks against the Shia. And clearly, that's not what al-Qaeda signed up for. They gave Zarqawi the brand al-Qaeda because they wanted al-Qaeda to be in the news for killing Americans and not Iraqis, you know, who were praying in their mosques or shopping in the marketplace. So we find al-Qaeda's leaders urging him to minimize his attacks in Iraq, and they spent a good deal of their time writing letters mediating between jihadi groups in Iraq. And the situation never improved. When Zarqawi was killed in 2006, the situation went from bad to worse because Zarqawi's successors declared themselves to be the Islamic State of Iraq that year in 2006. And by 2007, they stopped responding to al-Qaeda's letters altogether. And it took bin Laden a while to read the situation clearly. That's because his disposition was to think well of his fellow Muslims or his fellow jihadis, in this case, the Iraqi group. And in some ways, he was naive about it. And it was probably in 2010 when he understood that the Iraq-based group had gone rogue. And that same year, the leaders of the Islamic State of Iraq were killed, and we find bin Laden writing to one of his associates, noting that this should serve as an opportunity for us to change the name and remove any reference to statehood in the name and to see if we could unite as many factions as possible. Now, that group ended up coming up with new leaders without consulting al-Qaeda. And eventually that group eclipsed al-Qaeda.
Well, let's just deal with Abbottabad as well and how he was discovered by the Americans, how his location was established. So you've got an absolutely fascinating passage on that, because you're basically saying the documents you've seen contain clues that go beyond what is generally understood. So can you just talk us through that one?
Well, that was the last thing that I expected to discover in the letters. How did they discover bin Laden's hideout? So to put this in context, bin Laden and his family went to great lengths to evade the authorities. The reason why we have these letters is because he didn't leave the compound, and all communications occurred through letters. Now, these issues are not mentioned in the letters for security reasons. But fortunately for us, sometimes in 2010, bin Laden writes to his top associate saying, in order to speed up his public statements, he should perhaps send his public statements immediately to the jihadi media that publishes Al-Qaeda statements. And we find the response of his associate saying, you know, I thought long and hard about this, and absolutely not, because that would really compromise our security measures. And in that letter, he tells bin Laden how the letters are getting transmitted. So we learn from this and a few other letters, a few clues from other letters, that the letters were transmitted through a closed circle, and that consisted of two intermediaries and one courier in between. One intermediary on the side of North Waziristan, one intermediary on the side of bin Laden, and a courier in between. What is fascinating about all this is that at no point did bin Laden meet any of these people. The courier in between didn't know what he was carrying, and he had absolutely no clue about the items that he was carrying. And the two people who lived next door to bin Laden, the two security guards, they played a minor role in the sense that they would take the outgoing and incoming letters. They would meet the intermediary on the side of bin Laden somewhere, perhaps, most likely, I would say, in Peshawar, where the exchange would occur. But the main people, the two intermediaries and the courier, did not meet bin Laden. And the courier, as I said, didn't know what he was doing. At a certain point, we know from the letters, the intermediary on the North Waziristan side was captured briefly by the Pakistani intelligence. So we don't know what happened, but he was released afterwards. And in January 2011, the courier himself was captured by the Pakistani intelligence. Now, you can reconstruct or try to imagine whether the Pakistani intelligence shared intelligence with the CIA, whether the CIA was spying on the Pakistani intelligence. There could be different possibilities. But my own explanation is that the capture of the intermediary briefly, and then certainly the courier who was captured in January 2011, might have led to discovering bin Laden's hideout.
Right, so that tells more of the story, but it could still, the established story, which is that one of those guards you mentioned, the security guards called Kuwaiti, that he was the one that was, you know, discovered, that could still be true, that the Americans got onto his movement from Peshawar back to Abbottabad, and that helped them as well, right?
This was the CIA's narrative, and that is, I'm not suggesting that it is false,
right?
But there is something completely a missing part of that story, which I was able to uncover from the letters. But Abu Ahmad al-Kuwaiti was not the courier. The courier, I am very confident who the courier was, and I'm also very confident that the courier didn't know what he was doing.
But he was the courier, but he was a courier in the sense that he took it from bin Laden to an intermediary.
Sure, but he never went to North Waziristan, so right. He would have taken it to a. So, but yes, they did, and I do say in the book that they did play this minor role, and if you recall, the intelligence communities were, at least based on the media reports, for a very long time, they were looking for bin Laden in the Fatah, not in Abbottabad. So all of a sudden, it was around, based on all the literature that I've read, it was around August 2010 when they turned their attention to Abbottabad. And this is when they started having these clues. So Abu Ahmad al-Kuwaiti had been there for a very long time. It could have been anybody other than Abu Ahmad al-Kuwaiti who was living next door, and they would have still found him.
Yep. And did those intermediaries and couriers ever get arrested? Or, I mean, you say they were detained by the Pakistanis for a bit, but did they ever face a trial, or were they ever picked up by the Americans, or they just sort of fade away into life again?
Your information is as good as mine.
Right.
I know one of them was captured briefly by the Pakistani intelligence. Maybe that gave the Pakistani intelligence a clue. Maybe they released him because they wanted to track him down. Or maybe he volunteered some information. I wouldn't know. And then the courier happens to be the brother-in-law of that intermediary. And that's, in my sense, when the courier was captured in January 2011, this must have given extra clues.
I'd like to ask you about Hamza bin Laden, the son of Osama bin Laden, who was trying to see his father for quite some months, wasn't he, to get to Abbottabad to meet him, and his father wanted to meet him. You say very clearly in the book that he never made that journey. Why? How come are you so sure that Hamza bin Laden never went to Abbottabad?
Well, judging by the letters, we know that he and his mother had been detained in Iran until August 2010. Bin Laden would have liked for the two of them to join him in Abbottabad, and the situation was far too complicated. But eventually, the top associate from North Waziristan thought that it would be too dangerous to send Hamza at the time with his mother. And he was concerned not just about Hamza, but also about the people that he would be sending Hamza with. And in one letter, he explicitly tells bin Laden, I would rather that Hamza get martyred here with us rather than have him captured. That would be a big problem for all of us. And as late as April 26, that's a few days before the raid, we find bin Laden giving permission to his top associate to send, because his top associate had given him several alternative routes to send Hamza, and he chose which route in April 26. And one of the unique documents that were discovered in Abbottabad is a family document that was transcribed by one of bin Laden's daughters. They transcribed all the conversations that they were having in the compound in response to the Arab Spring. They were trying to prepare bin Laden's response to the Arab Spring. And the very last paragraph, which occurred a few hours before the raid, we find bin Laden telling his family, I've spoken, and I'm, you know, roughly quoting him, I told Khalid, and I'm going to tell Hamza when he comes, that neither of them should be speaking publicly.
Okay, just two questions. When you say that the routes were given, that was routes for Hamza to get to the house?
Right.
Right. And how many hours before, I'll tell you why I'm asking this in a moment, how many hours before the raid was bin Laden saying, I'll tell this to Hamza when he comes?
This would have been 3 to 4 hours, maybe.
Oh, really?
Probably less, yeah.
Okay, because the reason I'm asking you all these questions is that I went to Islamabad as soon as the attack happened, as soon as bin Laden was killed, and spoke to an ISI, Pakistan Intelligence official, who was speaking in an official capacity. I mean, this was a statement from them. And he said that Hamza was in the compound when bin Laden was killed. And I said, well, that can't be right, because he's not amongst the arrested and he's not amongst the killed. And they said, no, the Americans must have taken Hamza with them. And I got a question put in the White House briefing within a few hours. BBC correspondent there put the question and said, did you take two people away? To which the Americans said very firmly, no, we only took one. It made me wonder whether Hamza had got to the compound and left it, and that he had led the Americans there. But you're saying that can't be right.
It can't be right. Absolutely not. No, so, the last entry in that family document was just a few hours before the raid.
How do you know that, by the way? Is just a note?
Because every entry, they have the date on top of it, on top of the paragraph when they were having the conversation. And everything was set in place, and they were having a great deal of trouble even to bring bin Laden's wife. So it is absolutely not possible that this occurred.
One of the things that comes out of the papers that's particularly useful is Al-Qaeda's relationship with people, like a relationship with Iran, relationship with understanding of the Americans, of the Afghan Taliban, and so on. So you've mentioned a couple of times the Iran aspect to this, that a lot of these Al-Qaeda people, after they were chased out of Pakistan, ended up in Iran, a very surprising place for them to go. So can you just spell out for us what you learnt, in brief terms, what you learnt about why Al-Qaeda was in Iran and what the Iranians were trying to achieve and so on?
Sure. We know so much about this now because of the letters than we did before. Iran was far from being an escape destination for Al-Qaeda. But in the aftermath of the Taliban regime's collapse in December 2001, Al-Qaeda was stuck, as I said earlier. And you know, Pakistan was no longer safe. So many Al-Qaeda senior leaders and their families crossed illegally into Iran. There, the letters reveal they were supported by Sunni militants referred to as the Baluch brothers. These were Sunni militants who were working against the Iranian regime. And these, the Baluch brothers, were happy to help Al-Qaeda forge IDs and rent houses. For almost a year, they were able to evade the authorities. Now, Iran clearly knew of their presence, but couldn't track them down because they kept a very low profile and used their phone sparingly. So the authorities began tracking the Baluch brothers. And once they, it's by tracking the Baluch brothers, they were able to get to Al-Qaeda. And around December 2002, they managed to track them down. Initially, they imprisoned the men. And the women and children were more or less under house arrest. But this proved to be troublesome for them. The prisoners started going on hunger strikes and so on. And every time the women, tried to visit them, they needed to comply with the segregation of the sexes. And during these visits, some of the detainees would manage to escape. So eventually, Iran decided to, if you like, give them some upgrades. So they put them all into a large compound, and the conditions in detention were quite poor, and the medical conditions of many of the detainees, including women and children, were utterly neglected. We know all this because the situation was so dire that in 2008, Osama bin Laden's son, Saad, managed to escape from detention in Iran, and upon arrival in North Waziristan, he wrote this lengthy letter to his father, a 15-page letter, where we have a blow-by-blow description of the conditions they endured in detention. And after that, Al-Qaeda managed to capture an Iranian diplomat. And this is when the situation began to be quite troubling for Iran. The detainees began to riot against the prison authorities. On at least two occasions, they rioted. We know from the letters that one of bin Laden's daughters, she was hit on the shoulders by one of the Iranian prison authorities. So it was a much more complicated process, and there is nothing in the letters that shows any collaboration between Al-Qaeda and Iran. The hostility toward Iran is palpable throughout the letters.
Exactly. The Iranians were detaining them, and yet the Americans portrayed this as support at one point, didn't they? I think under Trump, saying that the Iranians were supporting Al-Qaeda in some way, which was sort of misleading and knowingly misleading, you say.
Actually, it wasn't just under Trump. It was also under the Obama administration, because the Obama administration would have had the letters, they had the letters in May 2011. I'm sure they had an army of analysts who pored over the letters, and they continued to make allegations that somehow there was a marriage of convenience between Iran and Al-Qaeda. Clearly, this has to have been the most inconvenient marriage of convenience between two entities. And now, were they doing it knowingly? Were they misreading the letters? I'm going to let others to speak about it. But from my analytical perspective, the letters make it absolutely clear that there was no collaboration and no relationship in terms of support between Iran and Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. Tell us about bin Laden's attitude to the US, because, obviously he famously talked about the fire enemy at the beginning of his campaign, if you like, and that was a big innovation. But then that sort of policy changed. There were phases in the policy, weren't there? Can you tell us about those?
I mean, bin Laden's views of the United States remained, consistent. We learned from the letters that, and also from some of his public statements, but they're more spelled out in the letters, that he had hoped that the 9/11 would deliver a decisive blow that would force the United States to withdraw its military forces from Muslim-majority states. And he thought that he could achieve that because the Americans would take to the streets and would replicate the anti Vietnam War protest and would put pressure on their governments to do that. Clearly, 9/11 did the opposite. The hostility towards the United States was always maintained, and by 2010, we find bin Laden wanting to do even more. This time, his group had been really incapacitated, and we find him writing to his associates saying that unless we change our strategy, Al-Qaeda is going to come to an end as a group. And his new strategy was to achieve what he called a balance of terror with the United States. And he wanted to do so by destroying 30% of the American economy. And this is where we find the letters. We have some letters that would that actually give us a detailed account of his future plans. He wanted to destroy oil tankers exporting oil to the United States. And he wanted to sink the largest oil tankers. Here, he did his homework. There's a limited number of these vessels in the world, about 730 of them. And each one of them carries up to 2.2 million barrels of crude oil. And the idea was to carry out simultaneous attacks targeting these oil tankers along several shipping routes. And his plans were highly detailed and methodical. He thought of everything: the surveillance methods the operatives should follow, the type of wooden boat they should purchase, the volume of explosives they should have, and so on. And he believed that the attacks would have an impact on the income of all Americans. And again, he anticipated that they would take to the streets and, you know, put pressure on their government. We find I said it was consistent, his picture, but we find him, there is, by 2010, we find bin Laden having, if you like, a restrained admiration of the American people. In one letter, he says, you know, they are the original source of power in the United States. We find him speaking more of the al-uqala in America, those who are the public intellectuals who are critical of their government's policies. So we find him being concerned less about shedding the blood of Americans and more interested in their votes. And this is, you know, I don't want to romanticize him here, but clearly his thinking evolved, and we see a different perspective on the American people than I had seen in some of his earlier public statements.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. But you're saying that, yeah, he couldn't really act on it by the time he'd thought of it in this way.
Well, the plans were in place, and he had actually authorized an operative to leave, and this operative was, you know, because of movement, he was unable. He was trying to leave North Waziristan. Fortunately, I think the Abbottabad raid made sure that this didn't happen, because this same operative was captured, I think, in August 2011, a few months after the raid.
Mm. Now then, two other countries to ask about Al-Qaeda relationship with. First of all, Pakistan, obviously. Huge issues over the years about, did the ISI know where bin Laden was and so on. Did you get any hint that even if the senior leadership of the army and the ISI in Pakistan were not aware of where he was, that officials at a lower level, maybe retired officers, but people sort of from the security establishment loosely, that there were any such people who did have knowledge?
Absolutely none. I mean, there are references in the letters about Pakistani brothers, you know, in terms of people who were supportive of Al-Qaeda. These were mainly in North Waziristan. But bin Laden, as I said earlier, went to great lengths to hide from the authorities. The children in the household, and at the time of the raid, there were 9 children. They hadn't been allowed to play outside without an adult supervising them because they didn't want to draw attention to the fact that Arabs were living in that compound. As far as the Pakistani authorities were concerned, and this is how bin Laden saw it, is that in that compound, 2 Pakistani brothers, Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti and his brother, lived there with their respective families. So bin Laden had, you know, did everything possible to hide from the authorities. So absolutely, as far as the authorities were concerned, there was absolutely no contact or no sympathy, and bin Laden couldn't count on anybody from the Pakistani government. So it's clear, and the other thing that is worth reminding people also about Bin Laden and al-Zawahiri's public statements against Pakistan were very clear in terms of their hostilities towards Pakistan. They called on the Pakistani people to rise and take up jihad against their government. We're talking about their public statements, not just the letters. And the letters make it all the more clear that this is the case. In fact, in North Waziristan, one of Bin Laden's top associates, we find him in the letters asking Bin Laden to tone down his attacks against Pakistan in his public statements, because Al-Qaeda was convinced that the ISI was helping the CIA in North Waziristan. They were convinced that it was the ISI who were, you know, supporting and allowing the infiltration of spies into the region. And whether it's true or not, I don't know. But this is Al-Qaeda's perspective. This is what Al-Qaeda believed. So clearly they had no support whatsoever from the Pakistani government.
Right. So just to pin that down completely, you know, it's sometimes said that, you know, a very Islamist officer, former head of the ISI, General Hamid Gul, who's now dead, but that he may have known where Bin Laden was. And, you know, he had a very strange relationship with the state, and, you know, much of what you said wouldn't rule out him having known. But is it your impression from the papers that you can't say whether he knew or not, or that he definitely didn't know?
I can say that not even Bin Laden's associates knew his location. It is the security measures they adopted that it was impossible for anyone to know. At one point, Mullah Omar sent a messenger. He wanted his messenger to meet with Bin Laden, and Bin Laden's top associate told him, "You'll have to give me the message. You have to pass on the message to me because it is impossible to meet with Bin Laden." Absolutely nobody knew. Not even the top associates of Al-Qaeda knew where Bin Laden was. And they were not meant to, for security reasons. Bin Laden didn't know, for instance, where Ayman al-Zawahiri was. We get the letter from Ayman al-Zawahiri the first time he's corresponding with Bin Laden in 2004. He tells him, "I am in a safe place." This is all that Bin Laden needed to know. So nobody could have known about Bin Laden, not even his associates.
Relationship with the Saudis? What have you got on that?
Well, again, I mean, let's make it really clear to all the listeners. Al-Qaeda is not just a non-state actor. It is an anti-state actor. They don't recognize the legitimacy of the modern nation state. From Al-Qaeda's perspective, the Saudi regime is an apostate regime. And we find from the letters that that Bin Laden was hoping to assassinate the top leadership of the Saudi regime in 2004. We also have two intermediaries who were in Saudi Arabia who managed to send letters to one of Al-Qaeda's top associates. And in these letters, we find that the Saudi authorities created many political prisons, that anybody who is sympathetic with jihad and with Bin Laden was in prison. We find that the prisoners were being tortured in Saudi Arabia because of their jihadi affiliation. So again, there is nothing in the letters that point to Saudi Arabia supporting Al-Qaeda.
Finally, and this really helps us look ahead a bit, as you know, we should do according to the title of the series, the relationship with the Afghan Taliban, which must persist to this day in the post-Bin Laden period. So, you know, that was a very important relationship before 9/11, and it's arguably an important relationship again now. So where, with the Afghan Taliban being in power in Afghanistan, where does Al-Qaeda stand in Afghanistan, and what difference does that make to its future, do you think?
Well, this is actually, it was more than surprising for me what I discovered in the letters here, probably even shocking for me, because here we find from the letters that as early as 2004, Al-Qaeda no longer felt safe in its own environment, and they felt that they would be betrayed by a large segment of the Afghan Taliban. In 2007, the letters are even very explicit about the fact that the Afghan Taliban want to dissociate themselves from Al-Qaeda and from any association with quote-unquote terrorism. In 2010, we find Ayman al-Zawahiri, bin Laden's successor, writing and fearing that there's going to be a peace deal between the Afghan Taliban and the United States, and he feared that the Afghan Taliban were ready to enter into such a deal with the United States so long as they get to return to power and would render Al-Qaeda impotent. What comforted him at the time is that Mullah Omar wouldn't allow it. And from Al-Qaeda's perspective, they saw a sincere Taliban movement versus the insincere Taliban movement. They were very loyal to Mullah Omar, and they thought that Mullah Omar wouldn't betray them. But the insincere Taliban movement in their views, they were ready to be on the payroll of the intelligence agencies, and they mentioned specifically the ISI. So they clearly feared many of the Afghan leaders, and they had been fearing this rapprochement between the United States and the Afghan Taliban for a very long time. They clearly were not surprised by the deal. As I said, Zawahiri predicted it as early as 2010. Now, what this tells us about the future is that the Afghan Taliban are clearly factions, and it's going to be very difficult for them to rein in factionalism. This is clear from the letters, and this is going to be a challenge that they will continue to face. As far as Al-Qaeda's relationship with the Afghan Taliban, they couldn't be happy, and I imagine they're even having to hide even more so than before, because from their perspective, the Afghan Taliban betrayed not just Al-Qaeda, but they betrayed Islam by, and I've been reading Ayman Zawahiri's public statements. He's been calling on the Taliban to realize that, you know, that the United Nations is not God's law. Entering into such organizations, you'd be violating God's law, and so on. So my sense is that Al-Qaeda is even more terrified now of the Afghan Taliban than they ever were.
Really? So you think, looking ahead, they still lack a place to be safe?
That's what I can glean from the letters. It couldn't be easy for Al-Qaeda. Now, this doesn't mean that the Afghan Taliban don't have their problems. I mean, clearly some of them want to take Afghanistan into a different direction. But it is also clear from the letters that factionalism within the Taliban is something that will continue to be a major obstacle for the Taliban.
Well, you've done a huge amount of work reading all these papers and analysing them and drawing all these fascinating conclusions. So thank you very much for sharing all your work with us.
Well, thank you for hosting me once again.